It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, your office holiday party might be serving less alcohol this year. A human resource expert tells us how workplace year-end events are changing and why.
First, it's time for our weekly look at national politics. We're talking about the results of last night's special Senate election in Alabama, a tentative tax deal between House and Senate Republicans, and a feud between President Trump and a female Democratic senator.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to Democrat Doug Jones defeating Republican Roy Moore in Alabama? Does it mean Republicans should be making changes ahead of next year's midterms? Do you see the results as a referendum on President Trump? Let us know right now by calling 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. She joined us now from Washington, D.C. Sabrina, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, let's start with the big news from Alabama. Last night, Democrat Doug Jones defeated Republican Roy Moore by just over 20,000 votes at latest count. Here's a listen to Jones during his acceptance speech last night.
This vote, I've said it before, Alabama has been at a crossroads. We have been at crossroads in the past. And unfortunately, we have usually taken the wrong fork. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, you took the right road.
Sabrina, if someone had come on the show about a year ago or so, or a year and a half ago, and said, hey, sometime in the next 10 years, a pro-choice Democrat is going to represent Alabama in the U.S. Senate, we probably wouldn't have called that guest back. That seems pretty out there. And yet, here we are today.
Well, I made the prediction yesterday, foolishly, that I thought we would be talking about Senator-elect Roy Moore this morning. And I should have learned the lesson to make my exit from the prediction business in last year's presidential race. But here we are.
And the big thing is people are trying to draw lessons from it. And I know it's safer not to try to draw too many lessons from one election outcome. But what are some of the let's start with the Republican side of thing. And there's some blame game going on. What kind of back and forth are we seeing among Republicans after yesterday?
Well, I think you're right to point out that you can't draw too many conclusions from one singular race, especially when one of the candidates on the ballot was accused of sexually assaulting women and, in some cases, molesting underage girls. So you had a candidate who already was viewed by a faction of the electorate as disqualifying or not someone on the Republican side that they wanted to show up and cast their ballots for in a special election, much less even in an ordinary election. I do think, though, that one of the most striking themes on the Republican side was that Donald Trump's approval rating in Alabama, a state that he won by nearly 30 points, was split fairly evenly with, you know, somewhere between 47-48% of Alabamians approving, 48% of voters there approving of his job performance, and 47% saying they did not, which is a stark contrast, and I think in some ways an indication that his late-stage support for Roy Moore may have actually cost Moore rather than helped him.
I want to give a listen to Wisconsin Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Here he was talking to reporters in the Capitol hallway earlier today.
What message did the election send last night?
The Alabamas didn't want somebody who dated 14-year-old girls.
I mean, is this a lesson for Steve Bannon?
I hope he pays attention that you need good candidates to win Senate races, yeah.
So is this a lesson for Steve Bannon? He was asked there. And Steve Bannon, former advisor to President Trump's campaign, to President Trump as president, and now he had really hitched his star to Roy Moore as the first in a series of insurgent campaigns that were going to knock out establishment Republicans and kind of take over. What's the talk about Steve Bannon today?
Well, in my conversations with allies of Steve Bannon, they are not planning to slow down or to step back. Bannon is someone who vowed to challenge every incumbent Republican senator who is up for re-election in 2018, except for Ted Cruz, with whom they have better relations and who did back Trump in a public way after initially declining to support him. So I think that when it comes to the Bannon wing, Roy Moore's loss does not mean that you won't have other candidates who may have once operated more so on the fringe, but now are part of the Republican mainstream. And I think the fact that the president was willing to throw his support behind Roy Moore, that emboldens other candidates who may not have the qualifications or who may have made very controversial comments in the past to still believe that they ultimately have a shot at winning. And it still was a fairly close margin. We are talking about roughly a point and a half. Now, in a state like Alabama, it's so much more surprising because, as you said, this is a deeply red state that elected a pro-choice Democrat. But in some of the other battleground states or where there are vulnerable Republicans facing re-election, as mentioned, you might not have someone on the ballot who has such an egregious accusation that's been made against him or her. And so I think Bannon doesn't feel that every single race is going to mirror what we saw last night in Alabama. The real question will be, what will Republicans in Washington do? Will they embrace these candidates as they initially did with Roy Moore, or will they try to really take this fight on and try to reclaim what they believe is the soul of the Republican Party?
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui from The Guardian, looking at the big national news of the week, starting in Alabama and the surprising Democratic win there in the U.S. Senate race. Let's turn to the Democrats now, Sabrina. They had a long run of bad news. Now with the Virginia, New Jersey, now Alabama elections, they've got news. They've got actual wins they can point to. And some of the commentary I've seen, and I can't remember who to attribute this to, was this could make recruiting candidates for Democrats much easier. If people are reluctant and tough Democrats, Democrats can say, point to Alabama and say, if Democrats can make it there, they can make it anywhere. Do you see a lot more people maybe coming forward to run for office for the Democrats after this?
I do think so. It was notable that Doug Jones took some time out in his victory speech to really acknowledge that he himself didn't think that this was feasible, and he was very reluctant to run for this seat. And it took a lot of convincing because it's not easy for these centrist or more moderate Democrats, blue dog Democrats, this diminishing breed, to feel like they can compete in this highly polarized environment. But what Doug Jones was able to do was prove that if you run a smart campaign and you don't nationalize it, that if you really focus on local issues, but also on Democratic turnout, then it certainly is possible to mount a credible challenge. And I think the fact that women, especially African-American women and African-American voters more broadly, made a big difference, that's something that Democrats can replicate in other states. Because once, as much as people try to characterize Alabama as this very deeply conservative state, it still has the same rural-urban divide that many states across America continue to hold. And that's where Democrats have an opportunity to engage and register and get the voters to participate, who often don't in off-year elections and only do in presidential races. And that very much speaks to African-American voters, Hispanic voters, millennials, and single women, some of the voters who Doug Jones targeted successfully last night.
Want to move on to what turns out to be a related issue. We're hearing that a tax deal has been reached between House Republicans and Senate Republicans. Now, Democrats are saying, and I don't think Republicans are listening so far, hey, hold off on any kind of Senate vote until the new guy is seated, Doug Jones from Alabama. Is there any kind of indication that Republicans would hold off if they do have a compromise deal that they could vote on?
Republicans have already been quick to rule out operating off any new timeline. I think they are eager to get this through. I think, if anything, the election has put even more pressure on Republicans to pass this bill because they are now looking at an even slimmer majority in the Senate. It's down now from 52 to 51, meaning each individual senator has a lot more potential to influence the direction of the bill and to raise concerns and to gain concessions. And so I think they really want to move forward now that they've ironed out a compromise. There still are some senators on the Republican end who have ongoing concerns. So they certainly have not corralled the votes that they need just yet. But I don't think, and even some of the Republican holdouts on the tax bill, even they have said that they don't believe that they need to wait for a Senator Doug Jones to arrive. And I think Republicans, they're looking at the math, and I don't think that they have any appetite to prolong this any further.
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui. She's a political reporter for The Guardian. She's with us to recap some of the top national news stories of the week.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. With the Senate and House reaching an agreement on a tax overhaul plan, what do you think about that plan? What do you think about the president's tweet aimed at Senator Kirsten Gillibrand? And should Trump be investigated for allegations of sexual harassment, as nearly 60 congresswomen have requested? You can let us know right now by calling 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about the latest political stories, the biggest ones of the week. Sabrina Siddiqui is with us from The Guardian.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Republicans should respond to allegations of sexual harassment against President Trump and calls for some kind of investigation? Do you think there are conflicts of interest in Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election interference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi. As a conservative, in a lot of ways, I enjoy what is going on with the tax plan and other things in Washington and the deregulation. But I must say that if they can investigate current senators for misconduct from more than 5 or 6 years ago, why not investigate Donald Trump? He should be held to the same standards as the other people.
Charlie, thanks for that call. And Sabrina, we've heard calls from some of Donald Trump's accusers, followed by a bunch of women in Congress, mostly women in Congress, for investigations into Donald Trump's allegations of sexual harassment. Some senators calling for his resignation. We'll get into that more. Can you talk about some of the latest going on there this week?
Well, I think that the point just raised is one that Republicans have really struggled with, as they have called for accountability for those who've been accused of sexual misconduct, and as they called for Al Franken to resign alongside Democrats who eventually did the same. Why is it that they are not holding the president to the same standard? That question even came up when many of the Republicans were saying that Roy Moore should not be elected to the Senate due to the allegations that he was facing as well. And I think that it just puts them in an awkward position because they're reluctant to take on the president. There really is no clear explanation that they have provided other than that the American people voted for Trump anyway in the election, even though they were aware of the allegations that were looming over him and his campaign. So I think a lot of it at this point is really symbolic, especially on the part of Democrats who now want to weaponize this as a form of hypocrisy, or what they believe is hypocrisy, on the part of Republicans, where there you have this watershed moment around sexual harassment. And it is clear that the president is being viewed as operating under a different set of rules than the other powerful men who have been accused across multiple industries, not just politics, but also media and entertainment.
Let's move on to a related note now. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was one of the Democratic senators. She's from New York, calling on the president to resign over the sexual harassment allegations. The president tweeted that Gillibrand had come to his office in the past begging for campaign contributions and, quote, would do anything for them. Can you talk about the reaction to especially that part of his tweet?
Well, I think it was immediately interpreted as a form of sexual innuendo and a highly gendered remark, because Kirsten Gillibrand was one of four Democratic senators who in recent days called on the president to resign. The other three, Cory Booker, Jeff Merkley, and Bernie Sanders, were all men. And the president noticeably only attacked Senator Gillibrand and did so, as you just read out, in a very suggestive terms. Now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, insisted that he did not mean anything by it, that only people whose mind is in the gutter would read it that way. But frankly, not just Democrats, Republicans read it that way too. Conservatives, I think conservative commentators felt that it was unhelpful at a minimum and inappropriate for the president to use such terms about a sitting U.S. senator, a female senator. And it certainly put even more of a spotlight on the president's misconduct or allegations that he is guilty of misconduct. If he wanted to steer the conversation away from his accusers, casting a spotlight on his treatment of women is not the way to do it.
I want to give a listen to Senator Gillibrand addressing the president's tweet this morning on NBC.
It was certainly just a sexist smear intended to silence me. And I'm not going to be silenced on this issue. I've heard the testimony of many women, numerous accusers. I believe them. And he should resign for that. I think Congress should do an investigation because we need accountability.
Now, for Congress to do an investigation, Republicans, since they're in the majority, I assume, Sabrina, would have to sign on. I don't know exactly how these things work. Any sign that Republican leadership would be interested in doing something like that?
No. In fact, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was asked this very question, and he said that there are no plans to pursue such an investigation. Republicans are squarely focused on their agenda. And that includes the tax reform bill that we were just discussing moments ago. They failed in multiple attempts to repeal and replace the health care law. And so I think that they're very eager for some sort of legislative victory, especially as they close out now nearly 1 year where they have controlled both the House and the Senate as well as the presidency. So I think that they recognize that taking on not just any president, but this president in particular, who has been more than willing to engage in high-profile feuds with members of his own party, would be politically damaging for them. The question, of course, becomes, will it also then be politically damaging that they are not holding him accountable as Democrats go into the upcoming midterm elections with what will undoubtedly be an argument that in this national dialogue around sexual harassment and sexual assault, Republicans were unwilling to address the allegations against the president. It remains to be seen how much of an issue it becomes, but I do think that you're not going to hear any change in tune on the part of Republicans. It's just not a place that they want to go or that they feel comfortable going.
Sabrina Siddiqui is with us from The Guardian. It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. We'll go back to our callers on that tax and health care issue you were just talking about, Sabrina. Amelia is with us in Montello. Amelia, hi.
Hi. I heard on a news report this morning that if the tax bill goes through, 24 million people would be thrown off of health insurance. Does this mean that the individual mandate is definitely being taken away? And if so, will the subsidies also be taken away?
Amelia, thanks. I assume details are still coming out, Sabrina, but what do you know about health care and the individual mandate in this tax compromise?
Well, as you mentioned, they are still working on the compromise, so it could change at any moment. But as of now, yes, it would still repeal Obamacare's individual mandate. And that, of course, applies to the penalty that individuals would incur unless they buy insurance. It certainly weakens the healthcare law's marketplaces, which are already in a sensitive and uncertain spot by reducing how many people would be covered. But I think that the exchanges themselves are not being targeted under this tax bill because they have to keep it within certain limits in order to pass it through the reconciliation process that allows them to clear it on a simple majority vote. The person to watch here is Susan Collins. Now, she was skeptical about including an individual mandate repeal, and she said she would only support that if there was also an effort to stabilize the health insurance markets that were established under the Affordable Care Act. And it's not clear at this moment that Republicans are going to meet that promise. So is that going to be grounds for her to vote against this bill? They can only afford to lose two votes. Any more than that would sink its chances of passing.
Amelia, thanks for the call. I want to touch on one more issue before we're done, Sabrina. President Trump's lawyers, some of his personal lawyers, called this week for the appointment of a special counsel to investigate the special counsel, Robert Mueller, who's looking into the Russian election interference and the Trump campaign. Why are they asking for an investigation of the investigators?
Well, there have been reports that detail private text messages sent between two former investigators on Robert Mueller's team that appear to show an anti-Trump bias. The texts were certainly critical of Trump, and so Trump's allies have seized on this as evidence that there is bias within the special counsel's team. Now, one of those individuals, Peter Strzok, was removed from Mueller's team in late July because of the discovery of these texts. So I think it is highly unusual that they are now being offered to reporters and exposed in this public manner. I do think that so far, when you look at the indictments that Robert Mueller's team have handed down, they have been very carefully handled. They apply to a lot of the, or they back up a lot of the reporting that was initially out there about Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, and others, and their communications with the Russians. So it doesn't appear as though they have stepped out of bounds in any significant way. And today you had Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, testify on Capitol Hill, and he said he can't think of anyone better than Robert Mueller to handle this investigation. So I think the real question will be, are they now? Is this an attempt to lay the groundwork for firing Robert Mueller? That's the concern that some Republicans on Capitol Hill have held, that the president might try to remove the special counsel. And this could be some of the early stages where they are trying to lay out some sort of rationale by exposing some of these private exchanges, even if they were handled internally by all accounts.
And tomorrow after 4:30, we'll take a deeper look at where that investigation stands with a professor of political science at Marquette University. That's tomorrow at 4:30. And Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sabrina Siddiqui. She's a political reporter for The Guardian. She's with us for a look at some of the week's biggest stories in national politics. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.